From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get to chat with a school teacher who has created a new musical about the life of Hans Christian Andersen.
I'll get a close-up look at the new tiger exhibit at the zoo.
Then I'll get a preview of the 45th Indianapolis Early Music Festival, and there's our arts calendar we call
What Will We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. June Clare, a teacher at Clay Middle School in Carmel, received a teacher creativity grant from the Lilly Endowment to research the life of Hans Christian Andersen. The research resulted in an original musical, Andersen, A Fairy Tale Life, which is currently under production in Carmel. It will be presented at the Studio Theater at the new Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, June 16th through the 26th. Travis DiNicola spoke with June about her work.
June, welcome to our studio.
Thank you so much for having me, Travis.
Pleasure to have you here. Really interested in this new musical that you have created about the life of Hans Christian Andersen. Ooh. Want to pronounce that correctly?
Yes,
Hans,
you did.
Not Hans.
Very good.
Before we get into the actual production that's taking place at the Studio Theater later this month, I want to go back to how this started. You received a grant from Lilly Endowment, a teacher creativity grant.
That's right.
Tell me a bit about this. I mean, did you apply specifically to work on a musical, or just learn more about Hans Christian Andersen, or how did this all begin?
Yes, actually, it was my second grant from the Lilly Endowment for, it's called a Teacher Creativity Renewal. Mm-hmm. And I have a background in theater and music, and am teaching at a middle school now, and they had no musical program. And with my background, I thought, oh my goodness, we should have one. So I applied for a grant, that was 9 years ago, okay, to start a musical program at my school, which I got, and we did. And 9 years later, they offered a second grant. And at that point in time, I thought it was a bigger grant. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, I would really love to go back to Denmark. I went to school in Denmark for a semester when I was in college and loved it, just loved it. And that was the year of Hans Christian Andersen's, the 200th anniversary of his birth.
Okay.
And that's when the idea started to form. I thought I could go over there and research Hans Christian Andersen and write an original musical about his life. And I had to apply for the grant 3 times, but I got it and went over the fall of 2008 and just immersed myself in everything having to do with Hans Christian Andersen.
Wow.
Including going to his hometown. We actually were in his mm-hmm. house. We went to his museum, and then we followed the path that he took. He traveled a lot for someone who lived in the time period that he lived in. He was born in 1805 and died in 1875. And, of course, travel wasn't quite like it is today, but he traveled a lot and went to Germany a lot. And so we went through a lot of the towns that he went to when he was in Germany. So we felt by the time we got back mm-hmm. that we knew a lot about Hans Christian Andersen.
It sounds like a great experience. I'm not as familiar with the Teacher Creativity Renewal Grant as I am with the Arts Renewal Grants mm-hmm. that many of our listeners know about. We've had many of the recipients, both Sharon Gamble and myself have both received the Creative Fellow Renewal grants from the Arts Council through Lilly Endowment. But so this sounds kind of similar, though, an idea for teachers to be able
Absolutely.
To sort of take some time and research something they've wanted to work on.
Absolutely. And
Very
the people
cool.
who have gotten the grants, I mean, they have done wonderful things, and it really does do exactly what it says. It renews the teacher. Mm-hmm. It gives them new energy, new creativity, new ideas. It's just a wonderful thing that Lilly does.
Now, had you ever attempted to write a musical before?
Actually, yes. My
okay.
husband and I are...
Because that seems like a pretty big undertaking,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes. And this probably is the most ambitious one that we've done so far. But we have written 4 musicals before. I call myself a closet writer.
I see. Mm-hmm.
I write in my spare time, and I've written quite a few scripts and, you know, a lot of things in my desk drawer that one day I'm going to pull out and sell. But in the meantime, Yes, we have written several musicals that have been produced here locally. Nothing that's been particularly published because, you know, writing is one thing and producing is another and publishing is another. So, and they all take time.
Right.
So I seem to keep doing the writing.
Well, tell me about this part of the process, because once you finish your renewal grant and you've created this musical, that next step of getting someone to actually produce it, that's a pretty big step.
That's right.
How did this come about?
Well, we happen to have a relationship with the people that run the Carmel Repertory Theater, and I had hoped to do it at my school, but the auditorium is in great use.
And you're at Clay Middle School, correct?
Yes, Clay Middle School in Carmel. And so I approached them and said, hey, you know, how would you like for us to do our... They knew that we were doing the project. I didn't even get the sentence finished, and they said, yes.
Nice.
And I thought, well, that's wonderful. I mean, to get to do it at the new Carmel Performing Arts Center is like a dream come true. So it's an amazing opportunity for us. And this is one that we're hoping that maybe it'll go further than just, you know, being done here locally.
Well, congratulations on all that.
Thank you.
Let's start with... I'm very curious about the cast, because I know you have a very interesting cast, but we're going to just leave that as a teaser for a moment.
Okay.
Tell me a bit about the show itself. Is it for kids? Is it for adults? It's obviously it's focused on the life of Hans Christian Andersen. And
yes.
Does it use his tales? How does it all come together?
Yes. You know, when I first started, my plan was to do a little bit about Hans Christian Andersen and then go into the fairy tales. The more I researched Hans Christian Andersen, the more I thought the story is the man himself. His life is utterly fascinating. He lived at a period of time when, of course, historically and musically, they were transitioning from what they called the classical period to the romantic period. Things went from being rational and very academic to being very human and very back to nature and the original wild child, you might call it. And so when Hans Christian landed in Copenhagen in 1819, the intelligentsia of that group of that time in Copenhagen were ripe for someone like him, because he was not very well educated. He was born in this small town on this small island of Odense, and although it was the second biggest city in Denmark, it still was very small. But because it was, actually it was the home of the summer home of the Prince of Denmark at the time. And so they had a theater. So once he went to the theater, that was it. Everything was about theater for him. And so when he got to Copenhagen, semi-literate, but totally, utterly determined to be famous.
Wow. I'm so surprised by just the first part of the story that he wasn't well educated. I mean, that just seems to run contrary to what you would imagine him to be.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, that's how we start the show, because once he got to Copenhagen and he kept knocking on doors and absolutely would not give up. And finally, because he was so persistent, he actually got, first of all, he got to get into the dancing classes, then the acting classes, then the singing classes at the Royal Danish Theater. And, you know, one by one, they said, oh, my gosh, this guy is impossible, but we can't get rid of him. And, you know, when he saw that he was failing in that, he decided to write a play. He had never written anything before except, you know, his little scribbles that he had done as a child, and presented it to the committee. Well, they saw a spark of talent in him, but it was so poorly written, they decided they were going to send him to school on the king's dollar, and they sent him to grammar school.
Wow, this is amazing.
At 17, he went to a school 67 miles from Copenhagen. It was a Latin school, and he was in class with boys who were 11 years old. And he did that for 6 years before they let him come back and start writing.
And do you have any sense of what his attitude was during that time?
Oh, he was miserable. It was the most miserable time of his life. And what made it even worse was he had a teacher who was a very brilliant man, but he also, he was not a believer in the whole romantic notion of education. He was a strict academician, mm-hmm. and he had no patience for a boy that they called him Dreamy, mm-hmm. And he wanted to write poetry sure. and so forth. They had no patience for that whatsoever, or Meisling didn't, and he was very cruel to him. In fact, Anderson had nightmares about Meisling for the rest of his life.
But Anderson knew he had to go through this if he wanted to succeed the way he wanted to.
Well, yes, because, I mean, here he was a poor boy. Yeah. You know, he was born to a mom who was illiterate and a dad who died when he was only 11. So, I mean, you know, to have that opportunity yeah. presented by the king and you're 19, yeah. you're pretty much going to do it.
Right.
And so he did until finally, after 6 years, one of his teachers took pity on him and went to his mentor, who was a gentleman by the name of Jonas Collin, back in Copenhagen. And he was a very... he was very high up in the king's cabinet, as it were, and he was head of the Royal Theater. He was the businessman. And because Anderson was given to histrionics, he would just say, oh, now it can't be that bad. It's going to be okay. And until the school teacher came and said, no, it really is that bad.
Huh.
Get him out of there
yeah.
now. And we incorporated all that into the musical,
wow.
by the way.
Well,
it's kind of exciting.
Well, I don't want you to give it all away, but what an amazing story.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, and now, the musical that you've created about Hans Christian Andersen's life, mm-hmm. I mean, is it appropriate, though, for kids?
It is. We're hoping that families will come. Mm-hmm. We have a cast of 45, mm-hmm. and I say we have children from 8 and, I shouldn't say children, but cast members from 8 to 80. Not quite true,
about
but.
The cast. Because if I understand right, everything from your husband, kids from the school, some city county counselors, is that right?
That's it, absolutely right. No, my husband's not in it. He's
okay.
the tech director.
Well,
He is helping out. He's
okay.
Working on the set uh-huh. very diligently. But yes, we have two members of the Carmel mm-hmm. City Council, Rick Sharp, who is the former president, wonderful actor, singer, by the way, and Eric Seidensticker, who is the current president of the council. And they have, and I should say, we also have the Carmel City Attorney, Doug Haney.
Now, how'd you get these gentlemen?
Well, you know, hey, we had auditions and, you know, who could resist a story about Hans Christian Andersen?
Okay.
They came. We have Bernard Werger, who is the retired head of the drama department at Butler University.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very fine actor, professional actor. And he plays, by the way, Simon Meisling, does a wonderful job. And then we have some of my students, both mm-hmm. Past and present, who auditioned for the show. And we're having a ball.
And who plays Hans?
Actually, we did the whole arc of his life, and
okay,
so we have Hans Christian
uh-huh,
mm-hmm. at three different ages. We have a boy, Blake Miller, who plays him as a child.
Mm-hmm.
We have Eric Wigand, a very brilliant young actor. He's 17 years old, and he plays teen Anderson. And then we have Rick Sharp, who plays mature Anderson. And Rick doesn't come in until the second act.
Now, regarding the music,
mm-hmm.
is the music in a style that's specific to the period of Anderson's life, or is it contemporary, or how do you bring that together?
Yes, that's a good question. And actually, it is traditional, and we certainly pay homage to the Romantic period. But, you know, some of that music is mm-hmm. a little overly sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a modern sensibility to it.
Mm-hmm.
We have ballads. We have our song Welcome to Copenhagen actually has a samba rhythm to it. And by the way, I need to mention that the composer of the music
yes.
is a young man by the name of Derek Hakes. Very, very brilliant young musician. And basically what we said is, okay, at this place, and by the way, let me go back to the fact that Hans Christian Andersen's mother was very superstitious. His father was educated, his mother was superstitious. So, you know, you merge those two together, and he used that superstition in doing his fairy tales. Anyway, his mother took him to see a fortune teller, Madame Meta. And so we have Meta sing a song that's very dark and gypsy-like as she predicts the future for Hans Christian. And we have ballads.
Mm-hmm.
We have an extraordinary, gorgeous ballad about that is based on the first poem that Hans Christian Andersen wrote called The Dying Child. And it was the first poem that had been written from the vantage point of the child.
Hmm.
And he wrote it when he was so miserable under Simon Meisling's tutelage.
Oh.
And a teacher, he showed it to a teacher. That teacher left and took it to a German newspaper. It got published, and he didn't even know it. And he was actually famous in France before he was famous in Denmark.
Wow. This just sounds like, what a great, great story.
It has been a wonderful, wonderful.
And it sounds like a great process for you. And
yes.
A great cast and so on. Before we wrap this up, is there anyone else you want to make sure you thank? Because I know a lot of people have come together to make this happen.
Oh, my goodness. Well, of course, my husband, who believed in the dream, and the Lilly Endowment that made it possible for me to do this. Julia Victrup is a lady who lives in Carmel who is married to a Dane. And she was sort of our advisors on all things Danish. And I should add, by the way, that mm-hmm. we're going to have an opening gala on Friday, June 17th. And Andy Murphy, who is a person you all might know locally, she has Anderson on her family tree.
Oh, wow.
And so she's going to be helping out with it. Oh, my goodness, I'm going to leave some people out, I'm sure of it. There have been so many people that have believed in this project and have worked really, really hard, and I'm really excited about it. And
of course.
I hope everyone comes to see it.
June, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Travis DiNicola with teacher June Clare, who's created a new original musical titled Anderson, A Fairy Tale Life. It'll be performed at the Studio Theater at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel from June 16th through the 26th. More information is at CarmelRepertoryTheater.com, and they spell theater T-H-E-A-T-R-E, CarmelRepertoryTheater.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Indianapolis Zoo is playing its part in conservation in a big way on several fronts, including creating a new habitat for its three emu tigers. The habitat, called Tiger Forest, recently opened to great acclaim. Sharon Gamble had the chance to talk with Nora Fletchell, VP of Conservation for the zoo, about these tigers, why they're endangered, and what she learned about them on an extended research trip to Russia.
So before we talk about the cool research you got to do and your trip to Russia, can you describe the, and let me make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, emu tiger to us?
Well, the emu tiger is actually the largest species of tiger found on the planet. There used to be 8 species of subspecies of tigers in the world, and now we're down to 5, unfortunately. With emu tigers being the largest, the males can get up to 600 pounds, and the females are about half that size. So they really are the what we call the apex predators of the Russian Far East. They're the largest cat on the face of the earth.
They're still pretty fast, though, even though they're...
I wouldn't call them speedy like a cheetah, but what I would call them is very lithe and agile and very deliberate in their movement. They are a stealth hunter. They're not a chaser. They'll sit and wait for their prey to come by and then stalk them that way versus chasing them down.
So they're strategizing. They're not just running after.
Yes, strategizing is an excellent way to describe it. They are a very thoughtful, deliberate hunter.
I was surprised to learn that they can and do eat bears. I mean, that seems like a pretty big prey.
Yes, that was one of the things that I was surprised to learn when I did travel to Russia, was the fact that in this particular part of Russia where the emu tiger lives, there are bear, and they do occasionally prey on bears.
What is their typical diet, though? What else will they eat?
Typically, they'll eat deer. There's a couple of different species of deer in that region, and wild boar is another big part of their diet.
Sounds kind of scary to chase down a wild boar.
Wild boar, actually, it's interesting. The researchers were telling me wild boar is actually probably even a little bit more dangerous for a tiger than, say, a bear. But tigers will eat anything from great big huge bears on down to mice, depending on what their needs are and what they can find.
They'll also eat domesticated animals. They'll eat pets if they're in the area, yeah?
Yeah, a dog to a tiger is another carnivore and
sure.
Therefore could be perceived as a threat. So the dogs that the people in Russia have as pets or as guard dogs are sometimes seen as a threat by tigers, and they will on occasion take dogs.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a significant issue, but it is something that they deal with, you know, on a fairly consistent basis.
So is that, let's talk about why these, why tigers in general, but this breed in particular is endangered. Are people are hunting them for their beautiful pelts, yeah?
Well, there's basically two issues. One is the poaching or the illegal hunting, and the other one is just the thing that we face with all wildlife is the human-wildlife conflict. As the eastern part of Russia develops economically, what you're starting to see is more roads and more development taking place. And simply what that does is it just opens up the tiger's habitat to exposure to humans, thereby leading to, in some cases, conflict. Now, what happens when those roads are built, that facilitates humans coming in and doing things like establishing logging camps, which actually sometimes, if done right and legally with in concert with the government, works quite effectively. But when it doesn't, or when it just exposes these tigers to humans, it opens up tigers to poaching. And a pelt of a tiger and tiger parts are still a large part of the black market for tigers. And so one poacher could make as much as $80,000, which is a huge amount of money in Russia or in China or, you know, other parts of Asia. And so that potential to gain that income is a huge incentive, unfortunately, for poaching.
And it's hard to just, it's not like you can communicate with the tigers and say, just move away from the region that the roads have just opened up in there. That can't be done.
Exactly, because these roads provide places for tigers to sit. Tigers like to watch and find prey, so roads are open spaces where prey will move through deer and other types of things. So the tigers tend to go to the roads because then it's easier for them to find prey. Then they're exposed, unfortunately, to humans. They're exposed occasionally to being hit by cars or trucks or those types of things as well. So it's one of those things where there's a very delicate balance there. And the researchers in Russia and the conservation biologists are working hard towards trying to maintain that balance.
Now, am I correct in assuming that it's not just the beautiful fur, but that there's some medicinal qualities perceived to be the organs or what is used for medicine?
Virtually all parts of a tiger do have some significance in traditional oriental medicine. And so it could be organs, it could be particular bones or those types of things that are seen particularly in China, as having medicinal value. So that drives up the demand for those parts, those black market acquired parts. So unfortunately, it's something where you have to look at the culture that those people have been living in for thousands and thousands of years. That's a very valuable part of their culture. And so how do we work together to get them to understand that the negative impact that has on tigers in the wild, not just in eastern Russia, but throughout a tiger's range, which is pretty much everywhere from India on east through parts of Russia, through China, and Southeast Asia as well.
So in the process, we should say that the zoo is home to three tigers right now, and tell us where they came from and kind of how they interact with one another.
Well, right now we have three. We have one male and two females. Now, in the wild, tigers live completely solitary lives for the most part.
Really?
Except for mothers and their cubs. And then they'll come together, obviously, for breeding, one male and one female. So our male, Pecha, has been with us for a little while. He came to us from another zoo. And Andrea, our newest female, actually came to us just late last year from the St. Louis Zoo. And Sila, who is actually born here at the zoo, her linkage is very closely tied to a female who was imported into this country as an orphan back in the mid-1990s. So she's kind of the link to the past with our tigers at the Indianapolis Zoo. We have a very great staff, and we have a very, very capable staff, and we've been able to actually breed and produce cubs for several years here. And so those three tigers, what you'll typically see is the exhibit area is actually two exhibits. And so when you come, you may see one of the females in one of the exhibits and the other female and a male in the other exhibit. Adult female tigers don't get along so well. So you probably won't ever see the two females together, but we are hoping to be able to breed a couple of those animals, and so we hope in the future to be able to produce cubs to continue to have that very important tiger population in zoos, so we can really show people what they're like and help them to learn what the issues are and the challenges are with tiger conservation.
In the wild, does the father stay around after the cubs are born?
No, he'll move away. Their home range in the wild is huge. A typical tiger's home range, if you look at the 465 circle around Indianapolis, mm-hmm. a tiger's home range is about half of that.
Wow.
So one individual tiger would have about half of that circle.
It's a big hunting territory.
That's a huge hunting territory, and they need that because that's their prey base. Deer and boar have very large home ranges as well. So in order to support one tiger, you need that much land.
Sure.
So
how long does it take for the cub to reach maturity, and how does the mother, I know this is a kind of a naive question, but I don't live in the wild, so I have to ask it. How does the mother get food while she's nursing the cub? And, you know, obviously she's got to recover a little bit from giving birth.
Usually for the first few days, she'll stick pretty close by with the cubs. Cubs, tiger cubs, just like domestic cats, are born blind, and their ears, they can't hear anything for the first few weeks. And so they'll stay very close. They'll stay in the den. The dens that these tigers build are very secluded and very secretive. So she'll leave the cubs, and she'll go off and she'll hunt. And she'll gradually, as the cubs' eyes open and their ears open up, she'll gradually start to introduce meat into their diet while she's nursing. But she'll leave those cubs for brief periods of time to go off and hunt, and then she'll come back to them, not in any more than a few hours.
Sure.
Or something along those lines. But then as the cubs grow, she'll teach them to hunt. Very similar to what you might see if you have a cat or a kitten, and, you know, they're tearing up toys and, you know, stalking and that. Tigers learn from their mothers. They are taught how to hunt by their mothers, and so that's how they learn as well, through experiment and trial and error, just like your kitten learns how to catch mice at home.
Yeah. How long does it take before the cub is old enough to is mature, basically?
Usually it's 18 months to 2 years.
Okay.
They'll move away, move off from their mother. Usually at around a year to 14 months, you'll start to see that separation.
And what's a typical litter? Is it just one or two cubs, or is
It's typically anywhere from one. Four is very unusual. So you're talking about usually two to three is the average size, but one individual cub in the wild is not unusual.
Wow. Yeah. When you obviously you had tigers at the zoo before you went to Russia to try to get a little bit more information before the newly designed habitat. What were you expecting when you went to Russia, and what did you learn that might have challenged your expectations?
Well, I think before I went, I had some very naive assumptions about how the people that live in that part of Russia would react to tigers. I just assumed that perhaps they didn't care about tigers, that they were kind of ambivalent about having tigers. But when I got over there, what I found was the people that live in these regions where these tigers are found are very respectful of the tigers. They like having tigers in their area.
Hmm.
It's a symbol of their heritage. It's a symbol of the wild, which they are very, very integrated. Their lifestyle is very, very integrated with the wild in terms of it's not very developed in that area where you'll see tigers. So they're much more dependent on the land.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this tremendous respect and almost reverence for tigers. When you talk to the people that live in the villages, they want to have tigers. They don't necessarily want to see them, but they don't mind that they're there.
Hmm. And there was a particular couple you worked with who've done a lot for conservation. How did you find them, and what did they tell you that's useful for you back here?
Sure. Dr. Linda Curley is an American-born conservation biologist who has dedicated her life to the conservation and recovery of Amur tigers. And she works along with her husband, Misha Borshenko, who is a native Russian. They live in the Russian Far East, and they actually are sponsored by the Zoo Society of London. And so I've got in contact with them through some of my colleagues. And Dr. Curley and Misha have been studying tigers for nearly 20 years in Russia, and they've been looking at this one particular state reserve and monitoring the tiger population there, working with the local officials very effectively at education programs about tigers, learning as much as they can about the habitat and the needs of those animals, with a long-term goal of obviously maintaining and growing a very viable population of tigers. Fantastic people, made a lot of sacrifices in their lives in order to be able to do this fantastic work.
In interacting with the tigers here at the Indianapolis Zoo, what are some of your favorite moments? What do you like to watch them do?
Well, in what's really neat about our new exhibit, the Tiger Forest, presented by Citizens Energy Group, is the fact that you will be able to get within inches of a tiger. Now, if you contrast that to Dr. Curley's work in Russia, she's been there almost 20 years. She's actually only seen a live tiger about a dozen times.
Wow.
So she has not had nearly as a robust of an experience in getting up close and personal with those tigers as you will be able to have at our new exhibit. Separated by just an inch and a half of glass from a tiger, you'll be able to see their whiskers. You'll be able to look right into those animals' eyes. And when I was out at the exhibit yesterday, our cats are wonderful. They're coming right up to that glass where they can, so you'll be able to see them. You'll be able to get an idea of how big they are and how magnificent they really look.
Sharon Gamble with Nora Fletchell, VP of Conservation for the Indianapolis Zoo. See the Emir tigers in the Tiger Forest habitat. For more information, you can visit IndianapolisZoo.com. Sharon?
Yes, Travis.
So a week from now is Father's Day, just to remind everyone out there. And I heard someone say the other day, you know, like June, it's like, oh, June, is there aren't any big holidays. Like, come on. What about Father's Day?
What about Father's Day?
So
Flag Day, Father's Day, our birthdays.
That's right.
The first day of summer.
There's a lot of good days to celebrate in June. So we will do that on that calendar that we call.
What will we do about June and all the things to celebrate?
I've got a perfect idea if you're still looking for a Father's Day gift.
Yes.
The IMA, Indianapolis Museum of Art, has created a special Miller House tie.
Cool.
Yes. And they're actually doing a special thing where it's 20% off at the IMA gift shop. And I'm thinking, what a perfect gift. Like, get your dad in a Miller House tie and then take him down to Columbus to see the Miller House.
Love that.
Very, very clever of the IMA.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I like it. It might remind your dad of homes he grew up in. Mm-hmm. That great
mid-century
modern
course,
architecture. There mm-hmm. you go. Mm-hmm. If your dad likes lively salsa and Latin jazz music, you might want to take him on Thursday evening, June 16th. To the Concert on the Canal concert, Orquesta Brava. It's one of the many, mostly Thursday evening concerts along the canal by the Indiana History Center. So a lovely thing to do, sit out in the fresh air, catch up with your dad and see what's going on and enjoy some music.
Well, lovers of true crime and other aspiring writers will want to mark their calendars for a presentation by the nationally recognized crime reporter and author Steve Miller. His book, Girl Wanted, The Chase for Sarah Pender, is coming out, and he's going to be at the Fisher's Library on Saturday, June 18th, 10 a.m., to talk about his book and sign copies of this. So if you are a true crime fan, as dads may be, and other people will, then this is a good thing to check out.
Wow. You worried me there a little bit. I wasn't sure where you were going with that. Hey, if your dad likes to eat, whose dad does not like to eat? I'm just thinking.
There you go.
The Broad Ripple Farmers Market has announced that it has expanded to not one but two opportunities to buy locally grown produce and acquire other locally made and crafted things. You can go to the regular farmers market on Saturday mornings, but you can also go on Wednesday evenings from 5 to 8. It's called the Wednesday Market in the Park, and it takes place, surprise, in Broad Ripple Park.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, a lot of great stuff going on this weekend. There's the, of course, Talbot Street Art Fair all day Saturday and Sunday. Also, the Independent Music and Art Festival going on at Harrison Center for the Arts. And speaking of Harrison, if you missed the opening of Something to Crow About 2011, which is become sort of an annual art event with artists Phil O'Malley and Lois Templeton, they are having a special event Saturday during Talbot and the Harrison Independent Art Fair at the Harrison Center. And it's a thing where they're featuring 250 different artists from five schools who are collaborating to create pieces based on the very fun book, Something to Crow About, that O'Malley and Templeton have been working on.
There you go. If your dad was ever a young boy, and I'm guessing he probably was at some point in distant memory, he might enjoy the IMA Summer Nights movie on the 17th, Father's Day weekend. The movie is The Sandlot. It's a 1993 film directed by Dee Evans. Here's the plot. Scotty Smalls moves to a new town with his family and learns the game of baseball from the neighborhood kids, treehouse sleep-ins, beautiful lifeguards, nasty rivals, and a beastly ball-eating dog make The Sandlot a big-as-life, quirky tribute to the truth of being 12. That's very sweet. Very sweet.
Wow. Yeah. That sounds delightful.
And that's at, where is that? That is at the IMA, part of the Summer Nights film series in the amphitheater.
If you are a fan of ballet, then you probably have been attending the annual Evening with the Stars event that the Indianapolis City Ballet has put on the past 2 years. Well, they are going to do it again. In fact, this year they are bringing back Evening with the Stars with a whole new bunch of dancers, but they've added a second night, a Young Stars of Ballet. Now, these are taking place on Friday, September 9th. This is a ways off, end of the summer. Young Stars of Ballet is Friday, September 9th, and Evening with the Stars is Saturday, September 10th, but tickets are available now. They have got most of the schedule of the different dancers that are committed to perform from all over the world. Literally, some of the best dancers in the world come to Indianapolis for these two nights. It will be very cool. You can check out more information at IndianapolisCityBallet.org.
I know you're making your plans. That's one of the highlights of your arts year.
Love that night.
If your dad, if your dad is a music lover, especially if your dad enjoys American classical music, you might enclose in his Father's Day card a couple of tickets to, or at least an IOU for some tickets to, the Marsh Symphony on the Prairie June 25th concert. It's the opening night program. It kicks off, can you believe, this is the 30th anniversary season for Symphony on the Prairie. Amazing. Edwin Outwater is conducting the orchestra in a performance of American favorites by Aaron Copland, George Gershwin, Samuel Barber, and Leonard Bernstein. So take a picnic out under the stars at Connor Prairie and hear the ISO. And another great way to celebrate your all-American dad.
There you go. Hey, if you live in Southport or near Southport, then you might want to check out the Southport Artistry Committee, also known as So Art, which is a new art collective. It's a group of artists sharing, selling, exhibiting their work together. And they're also forming art classes this summer at the Southport Community Building, made possible thanks to the mayor of Southport. And they're doing all different types of very reasonably priced classes, printmaking, drawing, ages 5 to 95, all types of stuff. You can get more information at cityofsouthportarts.org. Again, cityofsouthportarts.org. And one of the people who's heading this up is Claire Dillahay, who is one of the art teachers that I interviewed a few months ago, talking about saving arts in Perry schools.
Excellent. Good deal. You say your dad's more of a child of the 60s, likes doing that kind of hippy-dippy stuff?
you're really working this whole
I'm doing the whole dad thing here, right?
Okay.
And this is obviously not just for dads, but summer solstice, we were talking about, that's one of those June holidays that people forget. It's being celebrated at the Virginia Fairbanks Art and Nature Park a little bit early on Saturday, June 18th. And how do you celebrate the summer solstice?
How do you celebrate the summer solstice? It's the longest day of the year.
It's the longest day of the year, but it also celebrates the year anniversary of the Fairbanks Art and Nature Park. You can start with yoga at dawn. That will take place in the Park of the Laments. And you can also bring a drum and participate in a drumming circle with Stephen Angel, founder of the Drumming for Life Institute. You can take a park tour, sample art making at the Visitors Pavilion, or, this is my favorite thing, join a humongous game of freeze tag. How cool is that on the longest day of the year? And snacks and drinks are for sale in the park. So that's going on Saturday, June 18th.
What dad wouldn't like that?
I can't picture a dad who wouldn't enjoy that.
Here's something that might be for your more creative theatrical dad that he'd want to participate in. Sapphire Theater Company is putting together a series of workshops titled Playground for Performers. And they're doing these once a month, first Monday of every month. And they take place above the Elbow Room down on Pennsylvania Street, and it's a two-hour high-energy session that's packed with a whole bunch of different skill-building tools, experiential exercises, artistic enrichment, sort of like acting classes, but there's no theater experience needed necessarily. They say the only requirements are courage, passion, playfulness, and an open mind. It sounds really kind of neat. Basically, you know, sort of freeing your creative potential, and you can get more information if you want to about these classes if you check out sapphiretheater.com. Again, sapphiretheater.com.
If your dad thrills to the sound of young voices raised in song, he might enjoy the ICC Choral Festival. The Indianapolis Children's Choir will be joined by more than 300 campers on stage singing songs learned in just 1 week at the conclusion of the ICC's week-long summer camp. So imagine 300 summer music camping kids plus the ICC singers. What stage is big enough for this? Well, you guessed it, Clues Hall. And that takes place Saturday, June 18th at 3 o'clock. You can get more information or your tickets at ICChoir.org.
Hey, and just a last reminder, if you are listening to us on Friday night, Let's Meet PBS Kids in the Park is taking place on Saturday, June 11th. It only goes till 4 o'clock, so if you're checking us out on Saturday afternoon, perhaps you just had a great time at Let's Meet and getting ready to check out some of the other great events going all around the city.
Take your dad.
Take your dad. And we'll be back next week with more ideas for Father's Day and all the other summer celebrations on this calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
The 45th Indianapolis Early Music Festival, sponsored by the Festival Music Society Board, is taking place June 24th through July 24th with 7 concerts at the Frank and Katrina Basile Theater at the Glick Indiana History Center. Travis DiNicola spoke with Festival Music Society Board member Margot Shearing.
Margot, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, it's June, so it must be time to kick off the Early Music Festival, right?
It is indeed. And once again, we have an exciting offering for the season.
Well, I can't wait to hear about it. I know you've got 7 concerts, and that includes 1 children's concert. Do you want to just sort of, we'll go through the series? Because I know there's a lot of great stuff that that you're putting on this year. All the concerts at the Frank and Katrina Basile Theater at the Glick Indiana History Center. And just really, really fun concerts that you guys always have a great series of each summer.
That's correct. We start off this year on Friday, June 24th, with Rebel, an ensemble that has been here before and has made a lot of friends in the Indianapolis area. And they will be featuring Matthias Malta this year, and they will be playing Italian music. The season appears to be heavily focused on Italian music this year, but that's a little different than some of the other years just recently and should make an exciting counterpart for previous years. Participation.
I remember a lot of maybe French and Spanish. In the
Absolutely,
past.
And German, of course.
So a lot of Italian this summer. Nothing wrong with that. So that's the first concert of the season.
On Sunday, June 26th, we will be featuring Tempesta di Mare, which is obviously also an Italian-oriented ensemble. Mm-hmm. They are American, of course, but they will be bringing in a selection of things that will feature a lot of Italian music.
Now, have they performed?
They have never performed for us before.
Okay, very good.
But then after that, the following set of concerts will be Friday, July the 8th, Saturday, July the 9th, and Sunday, July the 10th. Mm-hmm. And they will all be featuring parts of the Baltimore Consort, which is based at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. And we'll probably bring in our delightful artistic director, Mark Sudek, as a featured musician. They will be playing fun and nice music on Friday night. On Saturday morning will be a free concert for children.
That's great.
And
that's
it will be at 10 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And on Sunday, we will have Viva Vivaldi with Ron McFarland. And, of course, again, the Italian. Mm-hmm. Ron McFarland is a master of the lute. He has composed many things for his own edification, but he also is a brilliant lutenist with music of Vivaldi or anybody else.
Okay.
He's a delightful personality from the stage, and if you don't come for the music, come for the view. It'll be great.
Now, did you say a lutenist? Is that
that's correct.
The term for someone who plays the lute?
Yes, it is.
Well, I've always wanted to know that. Thank you. And so after that that weekend of the three concerts in a row there.
Yes. Then on Friday, July 22nd, we will be featuring Plain and Easy. This is an ensemble that probably will steer away from the Italian somewhat because their original focus was the British Isles and even possibly the early colonial era of the United States. I believe the music will be Scottish and English, though.
Okay. And are they also a new group?
No, they have played for us before, a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And the last one is the one I'm very excited about. Uh-huh. Every year there's got to be one that really excites me. And this is by Sacabouche. They are a new group to us, and I am not familiar with them by sound. Mm-hmm. However, they are going to be playing music dating from the era of Cardinal Ricci in China. The music will have a strong Italian bent, obviously, with a name like Ricci. Cardinal Ricci definitely came from the Italian area. But he was evangelizing, or proselytizing, I believe is a better term, in China at that time. So this will be music that the Chinese people were exposed to. And they obviously, maybe not so obviously, but they did fall in love with it. And it has helped to forge a bond between Western and Eastern music that continues to this day. I am very, very enthusiastic about this concert and hopeful that that will be the one that will sort of surprisingly and suddenly totally pack our house. Of course, we'd like to see crowds for all of the concerts. One of the things our current artistic director, Mark Sudek, has brought to us is a sense of diversity of programming. It's not just enough to play lots of beautiful Telemann and Handel and Bach and Vivaldi.
Mm-hmm.
But he wants to bring in at least one concert each season that sort of goes on its own path, a little different from what we are expecting, such as this one this year with the bond with the Chinese. We in the past have had bonds that included the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
We've had Sephardic Jewish music. We've had a lot of different nationalities represented in our programming. And it always pleases me to offer this to the audience. And it's one of the things I try to stress in my interviews because I want people to know Baroque music was not strictly just heard in the European continent.
Because often, certainly that's sort of the assumption, that it was limited to just being European music, but not at all. You know, I mean, that's one of the things I think I find most fascinating about the early music festivals, not just the great music, because it is really great music performed by incredibly talented musicians, as you've been speaking of, but the history behind the music with each of these styles, the composers, the pieces. I mean, that's just as fascinating.
It is, and this is one of the things that has allowed me, as a connoisseur and an appreciator of this music, to really expand my horizon. I certainly always thought Baroque was, as I said, Handel and Vivaldi and all those great, wonderful people, but it is intriguing to hear pieces that don't even reflect those nationalities and certainly not the music structures that were prevalent in the era. And that's the fun thing about it. And I never, ever go to a series that I don't come away just thrilled with all I've heard.
Let me ask you about the children's concert. Going back to that, it's a Saturday morning, 10 a.m. It's a free concert. Now, is there any sort of presentation or anything to sort of give a context of the music to the
absolutely.
Kids in attendance?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. We don't just stand up there and play, mm-hmm. especially not with the Baltimore
yes.
concert. They have a strong educational ability within their ensemble, and they mm-hmm. always share and share and share. And what the kids don't learn from the music, they probably will learn from the discussion mm-hmm. if they pay a reasonable amount of attention.
Great, great.
This is a program that would appeal to children anywhere from 6 years old up. Mm-hmm. However, if an adult is listening to this and says, oh, man, that sounds like I might like that, well, he or she should come as well, because it is not restricted to families. It is open to first come, first serve until the hall is filled.
Very good. Hey, last thing before I let you go, we've been listening to a piece of music underneath this interview and going to listen to it a little bit more. Tell me a bit, what is it we're listening to?
We are listening to the Sonata Settima Sopra l'Aria d'un Balletto. And this is the music of Salmon Rossi, I believe, who was an Italian, obviously. Mm-hmm. Another one a little more esoteric than just Vivaldi. Mm-hmm. And I say that without rancor, because I love Vivaldi. But it is a lovely full-bodied piece, and it was performed by the Ensemble Rebel, which is our opening concert this year.
Very good. Thank you so much for coming in, Margot. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you. It's definitely a pleasure to be here.
Nicola with Festival Music Society board member Margot Shearing. The 45th Indianapolis Early Music Festival, sponsored by the Festival Music Society Board, is taking place June 24th through July 24th with 7 concerts at the Frank and Katrina Basile Theater at the Glick Indiana History Center. More information is available at emindy.org, emindy.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll get to chat with author Tracy Seeley about her memoir, My Ruby Slippers.
I'll get a preview of Camp Rock the Musical. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar recall,
What do we do? Please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.